This is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU, I'm Michael Monks. The Dozier School for Boys, Forensics, Survivors, and a Painful Past is a new book by Mount St. Joseph University professor Dr. Elizabeth A. Murray. She's been an educator and forensic scientist for more than three decades, and her knowledge has landed her regular appearances on TV programs like National Geographic Channel's Skeleton Crew, Discover Health Channel's Skeleton Stories, and others. Mount St. Joseph Professor Dr. Murray is now turning her attention to a troubled boys' reformatory school in Florida, where for more than a century, staff members physically, mentally, and sexually abused the boys who were sent there. Some of those boys died. And joining us now to talk about the school is professor in the Department of Biology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Elizabeth Murray. Welcome, Dr. Murray.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
If you'd like to join our conversation, or if you have questions about this story around the Dozier School for Boys out of Florida, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can email your comments to talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. I do want to start with a correction on this. We were running a promo about you coming on, and I mentioned in that promo that you went to the site. That's not true. You did all of this work from away from the site because you can't really get to it anymore.
Right. The school itself was closed in, well, the actual facility that these young men that I wrote about were housed in was closed in the 90s, and it's not a place you can access anymore. But I did use primary source documents, and I did speak with individuals involved in the excavations, involved in the coverage of the school itself.
And forensics has played a significant role in the recent stories that are emerging out of this old campus there in the Florida Panhandle. Can you just give us an idea of what researchers are looking for and what they're finding on this site currently?
Well, the biggest excavation was done around 2012, and they're able to use high-tech surveillance equipment to kind of peer through the ground using technology called ground-penetrating radar, and they find what are often called anomalies, which just mean disturbances in the soil. So initial surveys are done on the surface, and then they use person power to dig in and literally see what the disturbance is. So in the recoveries from the cemetery, that portion of the exhumations, those exhumations are closed. But now after Hurricane Michael, I believe it was, they found some new areas of disturbance. Those were tested, and those have turned out not to be human remains. The site was self-sustaining, and there were a lot of areas that were used for different purposes over time. So it's hard to know which are graves and which are not, and that's why the science continues.
Okay, so researchers have been looking at this site for some time now, but let's just start with the very beginning about Dozier School, what it was. I know that wasn't its original name, but can you just give us a brief history about this establishment and the type of kids who were sent away there?
Right. The school was opened in 1900, so it had an 111-year history. And even from its inception, both boys and girls were sent there in the earliest days. But even from its inception, the original charters indicated that the school would be reviewed every several years by a board of governors. And it was very quickly found out that children were being abused, that children had sexually transmitted disease, and I mean kids as young as 6 years old. So it has a really checkered past, and the fact that it was open for 111 years is astounding to many people who look back at the history of it and look back at the reports.
These were kids who may have been suspected of crimes or maybe kids who had been orphaned. There were a variety of children who were sent away to this place.
Correct. Some of them were remanded there by the courts. Others maybe were truant and their parents were talked into sending them there because the parents perhaps couldn't afford, you know, to feed or clothe these kids. You know, one of the guys says that the only thing he was really guilty of is not having anyone to love him, and that is just tragic when you think about it. There came a point where in the legislature, because the school was self-sustaining, that they changed the rules about who could or couldn't be sent to the school and how long they would stay there because they literally didn't have enough manpower to work the farms there. So they changed the rules to allow kids to stay longer and allow the school itself to govern when a student was able to leave. So in a sense, it was modern-day slavery.
Yeah, when you talk about it being self-sustaining, it is because of some of the industry that was there on the site. So these boys who were sentenced or sent away to this place, they had jobs there. Now, the school was segregated
Correct.
Until the 1960s, the late 1960s, segregated between white kids and well, white boys and black boys.
Correct.
And that was also true in the type of work that the kids were supposed to be doing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. The school had separate facilities, separate schools. It had separate places of worship. It had separate dormitories for the boys. And by that time, it was only boys that were present at Dozier. But both kids who were black and kids who were white who have survived that school indicated that the black kids had it far worse. They had much more menial tasks. They might learn to do laundry. They might learn to do dry cleaning, that sort of thing, whereas the white kids were given the benefits of newer technologies like learning electronics, actually getting more of a full education. So there were certainly segregation, and there was certainly more harm that was done to some of the black youth that were there.
We're talking today with Dr. Elizabeth A. Murray. She's a biology professor at Mount St. Joseph University. She has a new book about the Dozier School for Boys, Forensics, Survivors, and a Painful Past. It's about a boys' school with a very troubled past in the Florida Panhandle. In 2008, Florida Governor Charlie Crist, who's now in Congress, called for a couple of investigations, one to look into the investigation of alleged deaths that had been unaccounted for at the school, and also to look into the physical and sexual abuse at the school. And you note that there had been questions raised throughout this institution's history. What was happening in that period around the time that the governor of Florida was saying we need to put some commissions together to really look into this stuff?
Well, what was happening is that men were coming forward who had been boys at Dozier. And I should point out that the book itself is written for grades 7 to 12. And one of the reasons for that is because the men who came forward in the mid-2000s to 2008, which preceded the investigations, those were men who were boys of about grades 7 to 12 who had once been at Dozier. And so it was really this kind of coming of age and recognizing the damage, the long-term damage that this abuse had done in their lives that caused these men to come forward and find advocates, and then the governmental officials got involved in investigating the school.
And what about the media's role in that period? There was some reporting out of one of the big Florida papers.
Correct. Carol Marbin Miller was one of the champions of these men. She interviewed many of them, and she really was the reporter that broke the story and got some measure of justice. She enabled the men to go back to the school. They had a closure of the, quote, White House, which was the facility where the boys were beaten on a semi-regular basis, some of them. And so they did have some advocacy there. Unfortunately, many of these men who came forward in the 2000s and spoke with Carol Marbin Miller and other reporters, they're now dying with little justice had in this particular cause.
What did you learn about why there would be so many unidentified grave sites there?
I think the majority of that is just a fact of time. Time passing. The grave sites were known to be there. Exactly who was in them was not known at the time, but then the team from University of South Florida investigated not just the graves themselves, but the records. So it was long known there was a cemetery there, but the graves themselves were not marked. And I think an attempt to then look back historically and not use the science on the graves themselves, but also use the research on the cemetery records, was able to make some pairings there. But when you think about the nature of the boys at this school, if they, quote, ran away, their parents could have been told anything. You know what I mean? They could just, if a boy disappeared, the officials at the school could have told the parents, oh, he ran away, without anyone knowing what happened to him, actually.
Dr. Elizabeth Murray is a professor of biology at Mount St. Joseph University and an expert in forensics. Her new book is The Dozier School for Boys, which takes a look at the very troubled past of a juvenile institution in the Florida Panhandle. Dr. Murray, you're an academic and an expert in forensics. What drew you to this story, being based in Ohio?
I think it's very important for young people to read stories like this, as tragic as they are, because just in the sense of the Me Too movement, various abuses in certain religious institutions these days, kids need to know that they have the strength within them to make these stories known. And it's important that we look historically at these kinds of abuses so that it, perhaps, even if these particular boys don't get justice, that, you know, events like this can be prevented in the future, just with an awareness of what bonding together and the power that you have, the power that the truth has, is very important.
And there is an element to repercussions for people who tried to speak out while they were in school. There weren't a lot of opportunities for kids to share their concerns to anyone who believed them or to anyone who would help them. So I want to get into some of the specifics of the abuse. It's very shocking. We'll talk a little bit more about the White House that you referenced, where a lot of this took place. We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Murray, the author of The Dozier School for Boys, A Comprehensive Look at Some of the Abuses That Went On at This Florida Juvenile Reformatory School. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our discussion about the violence and killings at the Dozier School for Boys in Florida. Mount St. Joseph University biology professor Dr. Elizabeth Murray has a new book about the troubled institution. She is our guest today. Dr. Murray, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So I want to get into some of the specifics of this very troubling abuse that took place at this institution for most of its history, apparently. You wrote about some of the fear that these students must have felt. If any of them got the idea of escaping, for example, there would be repercussions for more than just that student. Can you talk a little bit about the area of escape and some of the punishments that some of these kids might have faced had that taken place?
Well, I think there was an attempt to use some positive peer pressure in that boys the boys who had been there for longer, were supposed to convince the younger ones to not try to escape. If a boy did escape, not only was he punished, but sometimes all of the boys in his cottage or his dormitory were punished as well. The other thing was that the entire town was enlisted in some respects, because when a boy would run, as they called it, they would send out alarms, audible alarms, and people from the town were able to park along some of the roads that led away from the school, and they would receive a reward if they brought a boy back. So in a sense, the town was kind of complicit. And many of the individuals who lived in the town of Mariana also worked at the facility. So there was a real sense that they were a part of the school. Many generations of families, for example, had worked there in some facility or another. It was really a shame that was shared by the entire town. So when boys would run, they would sometimes release dogs after them. They had prisoners from a local correctional institution that would go out into the swamps after these boys. And if the boys never came back, it was not known to the school or to their parents or to their roommates whether they simply died in the swamp, whether they got away, or whether they were found and executed by people at the school and just never seen again.
I wanted to ask you about that angle, the role that the community played. It was in the Florida Panhandle town of Mariana, as you mentioned. But I'm wondering if the people in that community knew about just how these kids were treated inside the walls of that prison, or if they believed that these kids had been in trouble, they were sent away to be reformed or to pay a price, and that maybe they were doing civic responsibility and capturing the kids and returning them. Was there any evidence that the town knew about the abuse and the violence?
You certainly make a good argument that it may have been that the townspeople felt exactly the way you said. But so many of them did work there that I think they would have had to have known. I do know that now there's been talk about where to put a memorial for these boys. And the men don't want the memorial at Mariana because they feel that the town was complicit when they were students there, but also the town doesn't want it there because they feel like this has brought a lot of shame on their community, and especially these days when the people that live there now did not work at the school. It's just sort of a shared history of horror that no one seems to want to revisit, and as a consequence, justice is not being served for these men who were the boys of Dozier.
A lot of the horrors that you write about in this book and that the survivors talk about took place in a part of the school that became known as the White House. Tell us about the White House.
There's conflicting accounts about whether it was actually built as a holding cell for boys or whether it was built as an ice cream facility, which some allege. But it eventually became a part of the campus where boys were taken, sometimes marched there, sometimes in a vehicle. And they basically waited in a line to be beaten, spanked as the attendings called it, but to be beaten in this place known as the White House. They would be forced to go face down on an old military-style cot, hold on to the railings of that cot. And they were there. You know, a lot of investigation has gone into exactly what they were being beaten with. And no one disagrees it was a strap. Some say it was a strap that had several plies that included a core of aluminum or some other kind of metal. And the boys, some of them say they were beaten so many times they lost count. Other boys waiting in the hallway would talk about how there was a large industrial fan on the top of the building that would be turned on in order to hide the screams of the boys who were actively being beaten at the time. There was argument among the kids whether it was better to go first or whether it was better, you know, because then you didn't have to hear the screams of the other kids, or whether it was to go last because by that time the men who were actually doing the beatings were physically exhausted from the line of boys that they carried out these punishments on.
I'm talking with Dr. Elizabeth A. Murray, a professor at Mount St. Joseph, on her new book, The Dozier School for Boys. I want to read a little excerpt from your chapter on the White House, if you don't mind, because the way that you write about it makes it so vivid and scary. And I just want to share that with the listeners so that people understand what it was the boys at the school were dealing with. This is from Chapter 3, The White House of the Dozier School for Boys. Dozier boys described it as a pair of leather straps, each several inches wide. The straps were fastened along their length to a thin sheet of flexible metal of the same width. A piece of wood at one end of the strap served as the handle. Some boys later described holes in the leather that sucked up skin and blood as the straps hit a boy's skin. Survivors say they were hit so hard that the force of the blow pushed their bodies nearly 1 foot into the cot mattress on which they were lying. Others described how deeply the metal insert could cut into their flesh if the belt turned sideways during a beating. Survivors remember the foul smell of old saliva, sweat, vomit, and urine on the cot mattress and pillow. Both bore bloodstains and bits of tissue from boys who had bitten their lips and tongues to endure the pain and keep from screaming. Some inmates would bite down on the filthy pillow just to keep from crying out. The staff told boys not to scream. Some survivors think it was easier for staff to abuse the boys if they didn't cry out to show the depth of their pain. They believed their cries might have reached whatever remaining humanity the staff had. Some former Dozier inmates said they learned to scream only on the inside. That's an excerpt from the Dozier School for Boys, written by Mount St. Joseph Professor Elizabeth A. Murray, who is our guest today. When you were writing this and you talked to some of the survivors of that experience, how do they talk about it now?
Several of them have written books, and those books are available for others to read. And I can tell you that reading those accounts was, I mean, I see a lot of terrible things in my work as a forensic anthropologist, but reading those accounts from boys that survived that kind of abuse was one of the hardest things I had to do to prepare for that book. The firsthand accounts, and, you know, you're talking about memories that they endured for 60 years. You know, it's not something that just happened to them. It's something that they have lived with every day since they left that school. That kind of abuse affected their marriage. It affected their employment. It affected their sleep. It affected their health. It affected their parenting. So I think it's important to recognize that the trauma that these survivors endured despite being 60 years ago, is still as fresh in their mind as if it happened yesterday.
And when you read those words or hear the stories about the abuse the boys endured, it's understandable why some of them may have thought about leaving. But I want to get back to that escape part, because they were basically bribed or incentivized to turn against each other or to keep each other in check. Because as you were saying, you know, the other boys might try to intimidate others from misbehaving because they would be promised trips out to the beach. Mm-hmm. Only if all of them would be accounted for. If one of their own from their particular section of the building had escaped, that group of boys would be banned from leaving for a year.
Right. So if they learned that one of their cottage mates was planning an escape, they would often take care of the discipline themselves. There were accounts, including some boys buried in the cemetery, that were killed by other boys there. So it wasn't just that you had to fear the authorities there. You also had to fear some of the other boys. So you can just imagine these young kids that felt like they had absolutely nobody to turn to. Maybe they had no family, or their family had given up on them. They were sentenced there, perhaps by a judge. They had these terrible caretakers, and then no one, even their fellow boys, that would help them out or that would basically be there for them.
There was someone who spoke out, though, and it doesn't look like it did a whole lot of good. This was a psychologist, Dr. Eugene Bird, who had witnessed some of the abuse, and he testified before a U.S. Senate subcommittee during a study in that chamber on juvenile delinquency. He said, quote, "The blows are very severe. They are dealt with a great deal of force, with a full arm swing over the head and down with a strap, a leather strap, approximately a half inch thick, about 10 inches long, with a wooden formed handle. In my personal opinion, it is brutality." Why did nothing come of that?
As I mentioned before, the bad reports about this school went back to its second, third, and fourth years of existence back in 1904, 1905, and yet the school was in operation for 111 years. I don't know if it was just the unwillingness of, you know, it was a state-sponsored institution. Was it the unwillingness of the government to hear these tragedies and take them seriously? Were children just not to be believed? It is. You're right. It's unconscionable to think that this kind of thing could go on and these reports could be on record. And yet the school was in operation for 111 years.
We talked about the fact that there is an unknown number of boys who appear to have died on this site. Do we have an approximation for a number of how many people were dead there?
There were about 51 sets of remains that were recovered, and some of them have been positively identified through efforts of University of South Florida and their anthropology team, who got members of the public to come forward and give their own DNA samples. So there have been some identifications made, but a lot of the cemetery records there were already known. I think the questions still remain about the boys who simply disappeared. Are they buried somewhere on the site? Were they already troubled kids, so they ran away somewhere else? That will never be known. There are undoubtedly families who absolutely will never know the whereabouts of their sons who were sent to that school.
Dr. Murray, you're an expert in forensics. We've got about 45 seconds left. What role is forensics playing in telling the story of what happened on that troubled site?
Well, as you can see in the book, there are facial reconstructions that have been done for some of the boys, DNA samples that were done, and just basically an accounting to try to say, do the remains in the cemetery match the records? So that's an important avenue for the forensic science to undertake. So I hope that in its work, the University of South Florida can answer more questions about what happened to some of these boys.
The name of the book is The Dozier School for Boys, Forensics, Survivors, and a Painful Past. It's written by Dr. Elizabeth A. Murray. She's a professor of biology and an expert in forensics at Mount St. Joseph University. Dr. Murray, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.